This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, December 9th. I'm Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, tragedy in Port Allsworth as four are lost in a downed plane.
The community is greatly saddened and shocked, but I think everyone understands the implication of finding the debris where it was located.
We get reaction from Glenn Allsworth Sr. from this morning. Plus, the numbers of bull moose in Area 17C are not as good as biologists would like to see.
You know, I do have some concerns. You know, we have some areas where the bull-to-cow ratios are lower than we'd like to see, much lower in some cases.
But if you do bring one in this season, stay tuned this half hour for a recipe for moose heart migas.
You're going to want to sear that moose heart quickly so it gets browned and transfer that to a plate to set aside until after your eggs are done.
Plus, we'll check in on a new small business in Dillingham to see how it's doing this winter.
It was like minus 20, and I sold like so many Oreo blended drinks.
Those stories and more coming up after a look back at some of this week's news. A single-engine Piper Cherokee out of Port Allsworth went down Wednesday morning with four on board. An extensive search turned up no signs of the plane Wednesday, but late Thursday afternoon, volunteers searching Lake Clark by boat found debris and items belonging to those on board. NTSB Alaska Region Chief Clint Johnson says his office will take over the investigation of what they presume is an accident that claimed four lives.
With the news that the Park Service did find some debris that we were able to identify back to the missing airplane, at this point right now we're led to believe that the airplane is in the water. There is still a search underway for any additional debris right now.
The Cherokee was rented from Lake Clark Air. The plane was carrying four residents of Port Allsworth, pilot Kyle Longerbeam, age 25, 45-year-old Scott Blom, and his children, 13-year-old Zach and 14-year-old Caitlin Blom. Search efforts today will focus on waters of Lake Clark where the debris was found. The depth in that area is around 375 feet. Family and friends will gather tonight for a vigil to remember David Grunwald. The teenager was kidnapped, shot, and killed in November, though it took authorities 2 weeks to piece together the case and find his remains in the Matsu Valley. One teenager is under arrest for the grisly, unprovoked murder. State troopers say others will be charged as well. The Dillingham Superior Court will have a new judge by early next year, and it's expected to be either Tina Ray or Lance Joannis. Those two were picked by the Alaska Judicial Council after a lengthy vetting process of seven candidates. Tina Ray is the current magistrate judge in Dillingham and spent a decade before that with Alaska Legal Services. Lance Joannis is an assistant attorney general in Kenai and was a prior district attorney in Bethel. Alaska Chief Justice Craig Stowers says it's the council's job to narrow the list for the governor, identifying what he called the tallest timber.
Now, you may have a group of qualified candidates, but there may be several that, just truly are outstanding candidates that are the most highly qualified. And it's been the historical practice of the council to look for that tall timber.
A dozen or so offered public comment to the council Tuesday, which was overwhelmingly in support of Tina Ray for the job. The governor says he'll make a choice within the next 2 months. Judge Pat Douglas chose not to stand for retention and began her retirement last month. President-elect Donald Trump has continued to select department and agency heads, this week naming Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt to lead the EPA. Pruitt is a staunch critic and opponent of the agency, and while his appointment has been praised by some industries, it has environmental groups reeling. Tiernan Sittenfield with the League of Conservation Voters says the multiple lawsuits Pruitt led or joined against the agency shows he opposes its mission.
Scott Pruitt is an incredibly damaging and really a horrific choice to lead an agency that's charged with protecting public health and the environment. And we will do everything we can to stop him from getting anywhere close to the EPA.
Other news reporting suggests Pruitt is skeptical about human-caused impacts on climate change and that he opposed the EPA's efforts to preemptively block the Pebble mine under the Clean Water Act. Pebble has sued EPA, and those lawsuits are still being litigated in federal court. The 117-foot vessel Exido sank near Unalaska Tuesday night, claiming the lives of two crewmen. Good Samaritan vessels rescued three others. The Coast Guard led an extensive search Wednesday before suspending their efforts. The Exido was making a cargo run between Unalaska and Accutan when it began taking on water. The cause has not yet been determined. Former state representative from Fairbanks was killed in a plane crash on Fort Wainwright this week. 75-year-old Mike Kelly, the brother of State Senator Pete Kelly, was flying solo when he crashed Wednesday afternoon. And the state volleyball tournament is underway in Anchorage this weekend. In the 2A bracket, the Lady Wolverines fell to Craig in their opener. Carl Clark was at the game.
Went three matches, and our girls ended up losing that match. Craig played pretty well. They had a lot of coverage. Our girls played okay. I think if they would have a little more coverage and backing each other up a little bit more, would have changed this game around.
Dillingham then fell to Cordova Friday morning and is out of the running for a title. Tenalian and Unalakleet are seeking to bring home honors in the 1A bracket. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. Details continue to emerge today regarding the Port Allsworth flight that went down with four on board Wednesday. Debris belonging to those on board was found on Lake Clark yesterday, and this afternoon portions of the plane were found in the upper section of the lake. On board were 25-year-old pilot Kyle Longerbeam, 45-year-old Scott Blom, and two of his children, 13-year-old Zach and 14-year-old Caitlin Blom. They were heading into Anchorage to cheer on the Tenalian Lynx and their older brother in the 1A State Volleyball Championship. This quickly became a very tragic week for the tight-knit community of Port Allsworth. An outpouring of prayer and support has come their way from this region, from around the state, and from the village's many connections and friends around the world. This morning, before more of the wreckage had been found and prior to the names being released publicly, I spoke with Glenn Allsworth Sr. to see how things were going.
Well, I think the debris is not 100% conclusive, but I'd say it's 99% conclusive that the aircraft apparently went into the water. And so I believe that everyone is resigned to the fact that we're now in a recovery mode, not a rescue mode. And so today I understand they're bringing some underwater assets out somehow to see if they could locate a wreckage. But the community is obviously greatly saddened and shocked. And but I think everyone understands the implication of finding the debris where it was located. It was found, I believe, by a local boat that was out searching because the fog was so thick the aircraft couldn't get in that area.
Glenn, we're going to respect the families here and not mention who's involved. I imagine the names will be published by the authorities later in the day. The community is aware of who's involved and such, but these are all Port Allsworth folks, and we know that one family in particular was impacted very much by this tragedy here. What can you at least say about the community of Port Allsworth and who's been lost here, just in a general sense?
Well, I think that the community is so small that everyone knows everyone else, if not very directly or intimately, at least through great association and all that's happening in the community over the years. So it is an extended family, of course, pretty much everyone in the community, but there are several families, particularly the one family that had three family members in the plane. And so half of that family now is gone, apparently. We will have that conclusive evidence today, I would hope. To get an impact, Dave, of the impact of that, how many folks live in Dillingham?
Probably 2,400.
About 2,400. So it would be the equivalent of Dillingham having 48 deaths in one day. That would be the community impact. And I would imagine in Dillingham, if that happened, there would not be one person in town that wouldn't be affected. It would be almost a national tragedy of that scale. In Anchorage, it would be the equivalent to 6,000 people in one day dying.
I think it's safe to say that the thoughts and prayers of many people are with Port Allsworth this morning as those numbers do make sense to people. Glenn, you've flown through that pass, I don't know how many times in your 50-year career, but do you have any sense of what may have happened, that this tragedy occurred? Is this an ice fog situation in your mind?
My personal take on it is probably with the temperatures hovering near zero and the unfrozen lake steaming so bad, that initial steam coming off the lake is still in moisture. It's in liquid form as it steams. And any object moving through that fog would collect ice instantly, because the moisture would, as it hits an object, would freeze as it hits on that object. So I would imagine if the ice fog was very prevalent that day on the upper end of Lake Clark, which is near where the debris was found, I would imagine that with those conditions, I would expect the windshield in particular, but the propeller and all any service that is exposed to that ice fog as the plane is moving, the ice would collect on the impact area of wherever you were going through that. So the prop, the windshield, the front of the wings would all be collecting this ice. It's forming because of this liquid moisture rising off the lake that hasn't yet frozen.
Well, we may never know exactly what happened technically, but we certainly know what's going to happen emotionally with the Port Allsworth community and the families involved. And Glenn, I just want to thank you again for sharing some reaction from the community side and helping provide some context. And again, I'm sure that the thoughts and prayers of many of us are with you and yours. Thanks so much, Glenn.
Well, David, thanks so much for the contact. And I want to say a big thank you to our region. We've received calls literally from one end to the other of our region with folks expressing their thoughts and prayers with the community and with the families. And it's humbling and gratefully received that so many folks are so concerned and reaching out and showing that. And it's very much appreciated. And we will continue to follow the developments of what's happening here. And our biggest concerns are with the families that were directly involved and how we can help them and support them and sustain them through these very dark times that you're going through now.
The Blom family released a statement this afternoon. In it, they say pilot Kyle Longerbeam was an Alaskan guide and great friend to many. Caitlin and Zach were both well-loved honor roll students at Tenalian. Scott and his wife, Julie, are devout Christians and minister to college students and military cadets. Scott Blom was also the boys' basketball coach at Tenalian. The Blom's eldest son, Josh, is a freshman at UAA, and their second eldest son, Sam, is a senior at Tenalian and played in the volleyball tournament this weekend. Last Monday, the award-winning choir at the Tenalian School performed its Christmas concert. Here's a brief excerpt. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. It's been hard to count moose and study the composition of the herd for several years here in western Bristol Bay. But last week, Fish and Game's Neil Barton was able to fly extensive surveys. What the wildlife biologist found was not exactly good. There did not seem to be as many bulls in some areas as he would hope for, and cow-to-calf ratios weren't great in some areas either. On Monday, Barton told the advisory committee that he was worried that hunters might take more bulls this winter than is good for the herd's health if winter travel conditions improve. For more, I asked him to join us on this program. Neil, we always like speaking with you, and it's good to have you in the studio here.
Yeah, good morning.
Okay, so you put a shot across the bow with the AC to say you'd flown very extensively and were concerned about the ratio of bulls to cows here in the areas kind of close to where hunters live. But let's back up before that, and why was it so unique to get the chance to finally fly a moose composition?
Yeah, you know, here in the Bristol Bay area, we often don't get snow in the fall prior to antler drop, which is generally people feel fairly confident about looking for antlers on bull moose up until the second week of December or so.
Okay.
We've gone many years without having this opportunity, so it's a really good one to take. Obviously, it's very important for us to know what the ratio of bull to cows are, but we also get calf to cows ratios and, you know, looking at productivity from that end. So it was a very good opportunity. We got the snow, and we ended up flying probably the better part of 60 hours in the past 8 or 9 days. And, you know, I do have some concerns. You know, we have some areas where the bull-to-cow ratios are lower than we'd like to see, much lower in some cases. We also have places where they look pretty good, but most of those are distant from this area and the upper ends of some of the drainages and that kind of thing. So we are in the process of summarizing the data we have, and I'm talking to a lot of folks in our division who are really experts with moose management, and then I will be talking to the advisory committee probably again early next week and coming up with some recommendations or at least thoughts on where my main concern areas are and what we can maybe do about that.
When you talk about what you maybe can do about that, there was mention at the meeting of perhaps curbing the opportunity this month or making adjustments to the fall. I heard a range of opinions. Some folks said, let's play this very conservatively. Other folks said, we definitely want to protect the winter hunt for locals who use it as a meat hunt. What options do you see on the table? Do you think there will be a necessity to close some opportunity?
That could be the case. You know, one of my main concerns with the winter hunt in general is if we get the right conditions, if we get good snow conditions and people can really travel, we have seen a gradual increase in the number of permits we issue in the winter hunt to the point where we're over 300 in the last 5 or 6 years, and that's a lot of people. And if the snow conditions are good, people can fan out pretty well and really put some pressure on moose in places that we might not want to see that pressure. And really, this is all about, we finally had an opportunity to get some data, and we want to do the best we can in managing this population and keeping it, you know, as robust as we can for continued opportunity this year and into the future. So that's really what we're trying to do.
You got up yesterday as well to take a look at some other areas. Did you see anything worth reporting back today?
Yeah, actually, yesterday we were able to fly the area from the Wood River west over toward Manicotic and up into the hills south of Alaknik Lake there. And I was pleasantly surprised. We had a better bull call ratio and even more moose than I thought we would see, but it's still a fairly small number of animals, just about a little over 100. But we did see a few more bulls than I was thinking we might, so that was pleasant to see. But again, we're going to sit down here today and over the weekend, myself and some of the folks I work with, and then I'll be talking to the advisory committee probably early next week and lay out all the information we have and, you know, kind of see what the pace of the hunt is doing and go from there.
All right. Neil Barton is the wildlife biologist for the Department of Fish and Game based here in Dillingham. Neil, good to have you in the studio. Thanks much.
Hey, thanks a lot. It's been fun.
It's that time of the year to reach into the freezer and enjoy the bounty put away during the summer and fall. If you've ever found yourself thawing a package of meat or fish and thinking, what to do, well, our next guest is here to help. At her blog, setthenet.com, self-described passionate home cook Susie Jenkins Burrito offers fresh recipe ideas for our locally gathered foods. Past posts include spruce grouse and stout pie, lofty and moist buttermilk blueberry muffins, and massive batch smoky red moose chili. Jenkins Burrito has agreed to host a twice-a-month program here on KDLG with recipe ideas and to answer your email questions. We're going to call that Set the Net, Recipes Inspired by Life in Bristol Bay. She's here to lead that off with a recipe for moose heart migas. Susie, thanks so much for coming in, our very own Lynn Neary of Bristol Bay.
Thanks, Dave. I'm really excited to be here.
Moose heart migas. Migas? Migas.
Migas. Although I think that my father-in-law may get after me because I have a horrible Spanish accent. So
So if a hunter has been out and has been successful here, the heart is certainly one of the most favored parts of large game. Would this transfer to caribou, by the way? Or?
Absolutely. This could be used for moose heart, caribou heart.
Ptarmigan, for those of us that aren't so good at hunting.
Spruce grouse. We've made spruce grouse migas, too.
Okay.
Kind of any game meat that you have, or even a steak sliced really thin could be good here. But moose heart, this is definitely our favorite way to go. So you want to gather up your ingredients. You'll, of course, have your moose heart. You're going to want a couple tablespoons of flour, some cumin, some chipotle powder, some salt and pepper, some stuff in there to give it some spice. If you like jalapenos, round a couple of those up, some cilantro, hot sauce, sour cream, salsa, guacamole. These are all going to be great toppings. But the heart of your dish is going to consist of basically scrambled eggs, corn tortillas, an onion diced up nice and small, and some cheddar cheese or some queso fresco if you can get your hands on it, or maybe even pepper jack. The first thing you're going to want to do is cut up your moose heart into nice thin strips, probably no more than a quarter of an inch thick, a couple inches long at most. Mix up that flour that you got out in a small dish with your cumin, chipotle powder, salt and pepper. Dredge those pieces of mousse through the flour so you have both sides evenly coated. And then in a nice nonstick or cast iron pan, heat yourself up a little bit of olive oil to the point where it's hot but it's not smoking. And you're going to want to sear that mousse heart quickly so it gets browned and cooked all the way through, and transfer that to a plate to set aside until after your eggs are done. Add a little bit more oil if you need to. Take your corn tortillas and quarter them. Toss them in the oil with your minced onion. Cook until your tortillas start to get a little bit crispy on the edges and your onions turn translucent. Then you're going to go ahead and crack a couple eggs in there. However many folks you're feeding, just guesstimate for that. A good rule of thumb is probably 2 eggs per person and 2 tortillas per person. Scramble it up so the eggs are cooked just almost done, and then sprinkle in that shredded cheese that you set aside. So in your pan, you've got your crispy corn tortillas, your scrambled cheesy eggs, and you'll take that off, plate it, salt and pepper on top, put your seared moose heart on top of that with the good Mexican seasoning. Put on some salsa, some sour cream, cilantro, diced up jalapeno, guacamole. Breakfast moose heart migas.
It's breakfast.
It's breakfast. Or it's like, oh, I've been cutting up this moose for 12 hours and I'm starving. Then
this
it's dinner.
This is the one to do. Right.
This is the one to do. Because it's easy, it's fast, and all it's right. Wholly satisfying.
What do you like so much about taking our local gathered food and doing original things with it?
We have so much opportunity here in Bristol Bay as far as bounty, and every season brings something new. In the spring, you can tap birch trees and make birch syrup. We anxiously await the arrival of the herring. Every time the fiddleheads come up or the ramps come up, it's time to harvest again, and that's really exciting. People have gardens, of course, salmon, berries, moose, birds, ptarmigan, spruce grouse, caribou. The opportunities abound, and there are so many excellent teachers here as far as what people have been doing for centuries and what people are just trying out now. So it's a rich place in culture and in food choices.
You're going to bring some of those ideas to this new program, but you'd also like to field some questions by email. How do listeners get in touch with you that way?
Yeah, I think it would be really exciting if somebody said, wow, I got 6 rabbits this weekend. What should I do with those? Those are the questions I like, because then you stop and you think, well, what would I do with 6 rabbits? Oh, maybe I'd make curry. Maybe I'd can them. Maybe I'd, you know. So I would love to hear people's questions. I'd also love to hear what you're doing with the food that you're harvesting. They can reach me at setthenet@gmail.com.
We look forward to this program. We're going to air the first of these coming up on Wednesday the 21st, right before Christmas. That leaves time for a couple of email questions, but you've got some ideas in mind for that show as well, and we'll air that just after Open Line here on KDLG. Susie Jenkins-Brito with SetTheNet.com, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Dave. I'm really looking forward to this.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Every morning, a line of cars can be found at Dillingham's newest coffee joint that sits in the harbor parking lot. While many of our businesses slow up or shut down in the winter, Tide Table Coffee is bustling. We sent KDLG's Avery Lill to get an inside look at the fun and challenges of starting a small business in town. She brought this report.
It's below zero on a dark winter morning, but Chanel Faux grinds ice for a smoothie. She says a lot of people order cold drinks from her coffee hut.
I think every other car that comes through is a cold drink. And I think it's so funny that I'm buying ice, too. Like, I have to buy ice for the cold drinks.
6 weeks ago, she opened Dillingham's only standalone coffee joint, Tide Table Coffee. It's a drive-thru with a window for walk-ups when the weather is a little warmer. So far, business has been good. The wall inside is decorated with more than a dozen post-it notes, cheat sheets, with the names of regulars and their orders.
We've been open about a month and a half now, and it's been going really well. I think the community is really responding very well to it and are really enjoying the different options that we have.
Before opening, she anticipated serving 10 cars a day and going through 40 pounds of coffee a week. Instead, she serves more like 40 cars a day and uses 70 pounds of coffee a week.
Oh, hi! Well, you need breakfast.
Yeah.
What do you want?
I don't know. I want one of those reindeer sauces.
Reindeer
sauce? Jean Barrett is one of Tide Table Coffee's regulars, who came by to order a breakfast sandwich.
Oh, the Tide Table rocks, man. They make the best Americano in town. I always just drank drip coffee until the Tide Table opened up, and then they kind of, you know, talked me into something different. So it's all good.
But a new business is not without hurdles.
Some of the obstacles that we're going through, which I'm glad that we're going through now instead of the crazy busy summer, are the frozen pipes. And we're just trying to figure out different options that we can do just to keep those from freezing. Another thing that that's another good obstacle is just organizing, finding stuff in the actual shop and just making sure I order enough things, like finding out what the popular thing is currently and just going from there.
Susan Isaacs has been a small business owner in Dillingham for 22 years. She and her husband Gordy run a bed and breakfast, an auto rental service, and a plumbing and building supply store. Isaacs says apart from just the higher freight cost, there's another big challenge to running a business in Dillingham.
Some of the unique problems here are labor, finding good labor or reliable labor, and people that come to work. So as a business person, you have to be able to do every facet of your business yourself, because if you, in any given day, you don't have workers, you have to do it all.
When she looks at starting a new business like Tide Table Coffee, a few things stand out to Isaacs as key factors for success.
Regular hours, communication that you're open, making sure that your building is in good condition and isn't going to freeze up, and having a good menu. I think that the coffee shop will do really good business. People, in the past, we've had coffee shops and they've always done really well. People like to go and get a coffee. The drive-thrus are kind of nice, and I'm hoping that they do a really, really good business, particularly in the winter, so that they can stay open all the time and be here for a few years to come.
If business continues as it has, Faux hopes to break even on her initial investment in a couple of years, and eventually to expand her hours and start hosting festivals and events. She aims to reach those goals one cup at a time. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Next Saturday night, some talented young folks will be hosting a dinner theater performance in Dillingham. Pat Ingen is one of the coordinators, and she allowed us behind the scenes this week for a short preview of what the kids are up to.
We're doing a dinner theater on December 17th, and this is a short excerpt from Her Heart Belongs to Heartburn, one of the skits that we're doing for the drama theater. And our hero, Harry Heartburn, played by Preston Woods, arrives at the Steger Inn looking for a job. He meets the local sheriff, Les Law, played by Colton Benton, and the Backbite sisters, Bertha, Belinda, and Mary Bell, played by Angelica Marks, Faith Clavette, and Lotus Becker.
Howdy. Is this the Steiger Inn?
Yes. Come in.
You're a stranger in these parts, aren't you?
Yes, I'm Harry Hartburn. I was the best deputy sheriff in Bethel until I was laid off on account of the economy. So I took up cooking, but it didn't work out too good.
Why aren't you still in Bethel?
They ran me out of town. I guess it was because of my flapjacks. Couldn't get them off the griddle. Sticky situation.
I'm Bertha Backbutt, and this is my sister Belinda.
Pleased to meet you. Do you want to marry me?
What was that?
She was just joking. Such a sense of humor. Wrong man, dear.
Attend the Drama Club Dinner Theater Saturday, December 17, to find out who will marry who and get the Steiger Inn in the bargain.
Pat Engen there. And before we go this week, we can't help but notice many of us have been caught a little off guard by the cold weather. After two very mild winters, some usual to-dos for sub-zero temperatures might be going undone. For this week's show, we asked Jay Hoover at Motorplex for a few friendly reminders for those among us who haven't run our snow goes much of late.
My name is Jay Hoover, and I run Motorplex Repair here in Dillingham, snow machines and boats and motors in the summertime. Right now, what we've seen is about 2 years where we haven't been able to use these machines, and the fuel that's in them is no good. So that's one of the worst things you can do is start one of these things up with old fuel. Well, the common mistakes that people are making is they just start them up, and if they sound okay and they're running, they jump on them and go for a ride, and then that's when the damage can or may not crop up. You know, we get 87 octane fuel delivered at the pump here, and if it's 6 months old when we get it, and then you throw a couple of years worth of sitting around in your snowmobile without using it, you know, you've lost a lot of the octane, a lot of the potency, and what happens is it causes excessive combustion chamber temperatures in your motor, and it can cause an internal engine damage just with running the poor fuel. Best option is, if you're going to try to do it yourself, whether it's isopropyl, isoheat, or seafoam, use it as directed and get fresh gas in them and start them up and see how they sound. The best thing to do, just because of the potential for damage, engine damage, is to take it to one of your favorite repair shops and have them give it a quick checkup and give it their blessing.
Thanks to Jay Hoover for those tips there. That's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond. You can find this and past episodes at kdlg.org and catch our replays at 6:30 on AM 670 and at 8:30 on 89.9 FM. We appreciate and value your feedback, story ideas, essays, poetry, song, and of course photos from what's happening wherever you're listening from. Reach me at dave@kdlg.org or give a call to the station anytime. My thanks to Avery Lill for her help this week. I'm Dave Benninger. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here next Friday.